All right. Feels like fucking April.
It doesn't it feel like April? It's wet and rainy outside. I just got back from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Nice.
And it was 95 degrees during the daytime. And
damn.
Humid. Yeah. So this balmy 75 to 80 degree weather here in New York just feels like Arctic. I'm happy I can wear jeans and not sweat.
70 degrees is such a lovely temperature.
It's the perfect.
It's great. You could just go. You can go. If it just stays 70, you're fine.
Yeah. Yeah, love talking about the weather. It's my favorite. There was one comic, I don't remember his name, but he on this festival showcase, just opened up and talked about the weather in Raleigh for like a solid 2.5 minutes.
What?
It blew my mind that it's like, didn't you? You got to come prepared, man.
Yeah, just I mean, unless there's something, you could talk about a tornado. Yeah. Or, like, some wild shit. But, like, don't just be like, it was kind of balmy outside today.
Weather's been temperate. Right, guys?
Yeah. Almost innocuous.
Can you imagine what rent prices would be like in New York if it was 70 degrees year-round?
Oh, man.
Oh, man. That's... See, that's, like, the nice equalizing thing. Because every time I do have a friend from Los Angeles, it's just like, oh, I love how it's just always, like, 70, 75 there. I'm just like, good, you'll never come here. Like, I mean, you may visit. You will definitely visit, but you'll never be here.
I think that kind of weather dulls your senses.
Yeah, it makes you like a zombie.
Basically.
I was watching this Anthony Bourdain episode that was my favorite one, and it didn't have anything to do with exotic foods, but it was him traveling to Antarctica.
Oh, that was a great one.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's your favorite episode?
Well, yeah, I think... Coming from like almost a sci-fi perspective, I thought this is what it would be like if we terraformed another planet. Or, you know, we set up a colony on the moon because nothing can live there.
It definitely had the Thing vibe.
Right. And also the everybody, like all these, you'd think that no one would want to go back, but you see all these people that are addicted to spending, you know, 12 to 17 to 20 seasons up there. They go back every summertime to work. And one thing they all brought up was how everyone there seemed like they were valued. Everyone had a purpose.
Yeah.
Whereas here, you know, if you're a high-end corporate lawyer, you never engage with a plumber or an electrician.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And there, the most esteemed scientist is on equal playing field in the cafeteria with the lowest plumber. Because everyone's role is super important. So it was like as socialist it was a socialist utopia.
Yeah. A colonialist mentality almost, though, with the fact that everyone has like a set purpose and each piece is as important as the next.
Each finger on the hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my dad he like would love to bring up every once in a while, like whenever Antarctica got mentioned, he was like, you know, what's technically a desert because they don't get any rainfall, and I just feel like, oh god.
Yeah,
he'd love doing it just because like it doesn't rain in Antarctica. It snows.
It's ecosystem ambiguous.
Yeah,
eco ambiguous.
Yeah, I actually had a friend who went down there and like was I think he actually did work in a cafeteria down there, but he was like a very proto hip dude, and like you just mentioned like all the fingers on the hand are necessary, but like I have like huge questions as to what exactly he was doing down there. Like he was kind of gentrifying Antarctica to an extent. Cause I was like, I think he maybe worked in the cafeteria, but like he was like on that hip shit early.
Sure.
Yeah. So like I don't know what he would have been
doing. Well, you know what? They did have one cook down there, and if your spice game is on point.
Yeah.
That's very, very important because they don't have anything fresh. They call when the produce shows up like once every 6 months, they're like, freshies. They get really
freshies.
Yeah. Oh, freshies are here. They're excited when they get like a couple carrots.
Yeah.
You know, some celery.
Mm-hmm.
So the rest of the time you're just eating spam with like paprika sprinkled in it.
Ugh.
And some oreganos maybe.
I feel like they should be hunting more.
Yeah, the only thing I saw up there
training wolves
was penguins. They had a lot of penguins.
Yeah, they would have penguins. Seems sort of they're obviously doing science down there. They're doing studies and what have you. But I feel like a lot of their studies are just sort of like, global warming continues to happen. Like, or global climate change is happening. I saw another ice shelf cleave off of the continent.
There is just a constant reminder.
I can see a lot of horror movies coming out of this, or real life horror situations, because all of, you know, it's not sterile. There's just tons of frozen microbes and bacteria and viruses and other, you know, things that we've never encountered in our evolution, because they've been underneath this ice.
Yeah.
But as the ice continues to thaw, we'll have sort of a springtime for a bunch of new biological terrors.
It's back and forth, because like one, there might be biological terrors, and then the other one might be like, oh wow, the new penicillin just became available for the first time in 100,000 years,
which we'll need very soon
after the terrors. Yeah.
Yeah. So
also, hey, our entire colony has herpes.
Yeah. No chance. That's like opposite herd immunity.
Where did this herpes come from? Well, the last time it was seen, it's a zoonosis that hopped from pterodactyl fossils, frozen corpses, to us.
Ugh, yeah.
Yeah, Jurassic Park, part 5. T-Rex chlamydia.
Ice dinosaurs.
Yeah, hey, welcome to another episode of Eat, Pray, Judge. Yeah, as always, this is Gabe Pacheco on the first mic. On mic number 2, we have
Sammy Hamarne.
And you may have heard a strange voice on mic 3. And today we are
strange.
Blessed to have in studio with us the very funny Danny Feltz.
Hello there. I am strange voice number 3 today. Let's do it.
Yeah, we're getting in a time machine and going back to 2008.
God,
what a year.
What a year. I have thoughts about it.
Yeah, well, what was one thing that popped out for you?
About 2008?
Yeah.
Well, in 2008, I was 20 years old, and I was living in Portland, Oregon. And I don't know about you guys, but there was what was happening was this sort of like global recession in the economy, and let me tell you, the sort of lofty, fuzzy, soft goods, soft sciences haven of Portland did not fare great with it. And I like just specifically remember a lot of times, just, you know, being a young adult, being like, oh, I should get a job, and then in a certain way, I was in college at the time. I want to get a part-time job, and I would like go to a coffee shop or whatever to try to be a barista, and it'd be like, hiring a barista, 10 years experience required, or just some horseshit like that.
That town takes their coffee very seriously.
You need a PhD in pour over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, it was the stereotype that everybody, like, that was happening, where it was just sort of like the whole equation that like my parents' generation or even Gen X sort of experience, where they're just sort of like, you just go into a place and you give them your resume and you wear a nice button-up shirt. You say, gosh darn it, I'd like a job, please. And they're just sort of like, there's not enough jobs for the people who are qualified even. So that's the reason I have like zero food handling experience, because I got funneled into the customer service realm as opposed to the waiter service-y realm. And I slash bartender realm, and I've always been on like the other side of that fork in terms of customer service stuff.
You know, it's funny when you brought up not enough jobs. It made me think about the film Dark Knight, which came out this year.
Yes,
and one of my favorite scenes in it is when Heath Ledger's Joker takes a pool cue, and he has three goons from one of the other mobsters' teams. And he breaks the pool cue in half and throws the sharp end out to them. And he goes, we're hiring.
We've only
got a position for one.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's what happened to everybody coming out of the workforce, into the workforce in 2008.
Oh, mm-hmm. The greatest line in that movie came from him. If you're good at something, never do it for free.
Yeah.
That's a really good line I forgot about. Yeah. That's great. Yeah.
Sure. Well, you know, and a whole generation of kids learning about life from the Joker.
Yeah. I mean, if we're talking, I mean, this is like a pre-meme era. This is like where you got a lot of guys in their representative dorms and terrible one bedrooms with like a poster on the wall that says, why so serious? Yeah, like, you know, you got a lot of that, you know.
He was an entire generation's Tyler Durden.
Yes, yes, very much so, very much
Heath Ledger's Joker. And unfortunately, the Joker has gone from being a fun, silly, zany villain to to a role model for school shooters.
Yeah, oh man, this is like, I mean, I'm sure school shootings happened then, but not in the frequency and reportedness of currently, and definitely, you're right.
Yeah, he's the Joker's kind of become one of their floating signifiers.
Poster the dark boys.
Clown.
Yeah, I'm a dark clown, not taking anything seriously.
Yeah.
Yep, so 2008, that Dark Knight came out. You were in Portland, you were 20 years old. Let's see, in 2008, I had just started stand-up comedy. I think 2007 was when I began in earnest.
Sure.
And around that time, also, YouTube became a sensation.
It did.
This was, 2008 was a huge change in stand-up because we were no longer sending VHS tapes to clubs. Or DVRs, but now you could upload your videos. So some of the first video stars, YouTube stars, were coming out.
Yeah, this is when, like, Donald Glover is getting popular. This is also, I think I read a book on it recently. Twitter is 2 years old in 2008. Like you said, YouTube is about four.
Right.
YouTube's about 4 years old. Facebook, great, doing great. MySpace, still relevant, still a competitor.
I feel like that was the year I joined Facebook begrudgingly.
Yeah, I think it's
regretted
what a lot of
it ever
did.
Since. Monty Python started a YouTube channel that year, and subsequently got a 200% boost in video sales after doing that.
And it counterintuitive because you're like, don't give it away for free, but they did.
Yeah.
And then everybody bought their stuff.
Hey, nothing's free, man.
Yeah. This is also where, like, I think culture starts to spread out a little bit more too, especially in relation to YouTube, because I remember like Mighty Boosh stuff showing up on YouTube.
Old Greg,
and being like, what's this goofy thing, you know? And it's just like, yeah, it's just British television, you know?
In New York, 2008, Sushigate happened.
Oh, wow.
What's and that?
On the heels of our Hero Dreams of Sushi episode.
This would have been relevant if that movie was made in 2008. Yeah. So Sushigate was where two students proved through DNA testing that New York restaurants, high-end New York restaurants, would switch to the fish in their sushi from like high-grade tunas or whatever they were serving to lower test low-end fish like tilapia and not tell anybody.
I honestly, I mean, do I agree with people being deceptive in that way? No. But I also have come to realize, and I've only been here for about 3 years. In my 3 years in New York, it's like any way you can trick, like the very rich and what have you. Please.
Just siphon money from finance dudes.
And because like they're going to spend it on horse shit anyway.
Well, they probably love it. They're like, it's so good.
Yeah, exactly.
High test sushi.
I've never had sushi like this before.
This is killer sushi.
Yeah. What are we eating?
I move numbers around.
It's a halibut. It's a grouper.
This is when sushi is like, this is when sushi's like bae. That's when they're like that. It's like, it's not a new thing. I feel like it was a new thing in the 90s, but people are still like, yeah, I like sushi. That's my personality, you know?
That's my personality.
Yeah.
I'm really into sushi.
I remember moving to New York right when I got here after college. There were all these restaurants in the Lower East Side that sold happy hour sushi.
That's such a terrible idea.
Or all you can eat sushi. And but the thing was, so we would just fill up, I was allergic to fish, so I just ate like cucumber rolls or whatever. I was there for the sake, but I had friends, and they would just eat the fish and leave the rice, and then the waiters would come back and be like, "No, next time it's only all you can eat for 1 hour, you guys. You can't just stay here like Homer Simpson the whole time."
Yeah. I didn't know the exact number, but I believe a MetroCard is like $70, $60 for a month pass at this time.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. For comparison, what is that, like $130?
Yeah, that's right. So, but the cost of living keeps going up, but the prices stay the same.
Yeah.
Wages, rather.
Gordon Ramsay had a show called Kitchen Nightmares, which there was a British version several years prior to 2008 that was great. And then he had obviously released like a Fox version of it on American television. So he would go to kitchens or restaurants that were terribly managed, terribly run from like the food sense, and help them try to fix their product. Every restaurant that he visited through the 2008 season closed.
So there was just, you just looked them all up and they're like, yeah, they're not around.
Well, yeah, it was just, it was written on the, on my search engine.
Mm-hmm. All press is bad press. Yeah. Gordon Ramsay is the angel of death who is visiting you.
There was a comedy venue / reggae music venue in Portland called the Tonic Lounge that was, had like what was like the most consistent, best attended show in Portland for a long time. And they were like a Kitchen Nightmares case, or like a kitchen renovation. Like they actually went on television for it.
Yeah.
And their whole thing was they got, you know, the show stopped, then, or the comedy show stopped, and then they went on the TV show and they got rebranded as the Panic Room. And it like it was, it looked like, you know, Do Not Cross tape on the sign, as opposed to like just Tonic Lounge. And then, oddly enough, I think probably like 3-4 years later, changed back to the Tonic Lounge. And yeah, now they're presumably just like a slightly cleaner version of what they were. And apparently it was quite bad. We were all eating there, having various sandwiches. So yeah, that's always good to know.
Yeah, so what else was going on? Oh, Castro stepped down, bro. He retired from politics at that point and gave the reins to the dictatorship to his brother.
That's right.
Yeah.
This Obama's wasn't when he, elected. Too.
Obama, exactly. So
Times
you know,
man of the year.
for simply for being elected. Yeah. He hadn't really done anything yet.
No.
I think no matter what we talk about in terms of pop culture, the shadow looming over all of this is the financial crisis.
Yeah, it's
and
very big.
The moral bankruptcy of the United States at this point, having entered what it's like fifth, or maybe sixth year of war in Iraq. And,
yeah,
it's, you know, our global campaign of in a war as participants in a war on terror,
fighting terror with terror.
Yeah,
basically just drone bombing all of Afghanistan and Iraq.
This is before people even knew what drones were, really. I mean, it's like the military definitely used them, but it wasn't like a thing that got escalated the way it did in, like, say, 2012, where
That's right.
Obama was basically known as the drone president.
He was a mad bomber.
Yeah, he was.
I feel like Americans didn't know what drones were, but a lot of villagers in Afghanistan and the Korangal Valley knew exactly what drones were.
Yeah,
yeah. It's
what are they? These electronic dragons.
It's back.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, whenever we have a wedding, these little baby dragons show up in Dracarys, all of us.
Yeah, it's oh yeah, Game of Thrones does not exist yet. I believe
that's true.
Game of Thrones, I mean the book does, but I believe it started in like 2009 or 10.
That's right.
And another piece of weird news, a Brazilian priest, Father Adelir Antonio, as part of a fundraiser for the church, strapped 1,000 balloons to a lawn chair and lifted himself up and then was later found dead in the sea and won a Darwin Award.
Dead in the sea. I love it.
You know what I'm very upset about with this is that I learned when you release those balloons, they float off. They'll float off into the ocean.
Sure.
And then dolphins will just be like, what is this delicious looking sphere?
Yeah.
And then they'll try to eat the rubber and die.
Yeah.
So not only did this guy kill himself, but if all these
killed thousands of turtles inadvertently,
just entire pods were wiped out by this man's Darwin Award.
So clearly loved God and had just watched Up. And decided,
was Up out yet?
I have no idea.
I feel like
I hope it was for context.
Yeah, if it wasn't, it was very close to being. Yeah.
Well, the movie that people loved, the animated film at this moment, was WALL-E.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I've never seen WALL-E.
Well, I recommend it highly. Maybe, you know, we could talk about it at some point, but it it's prescient.
Yeah,
how
that's
it looks
what it sounds like. Yeah,
humanity, and one thing that I have indelibly seared in my brain is like the fat humans in WALL-E, who, you know, and I'm not here to body shame, but this idea like obesity is such an issue in this film. Like all the humans have these floating lazy boys that they're in, and they just press buttons, sodas just pop out of the Lazy Boys and like immediately fill their gullets.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're not here. Look, folks, we're not here to body shame. All right, we're not here. But the only thing that I will stand with. Mayor at this time, Michael Bloomberg, unless he was a mayor, is the soda thing. Yeah, you shouldn't drink soda. It's really bad for you. It's only bad. It's right. only bad.
Oh, Up came out in 2009, so maybe it was inspired by this dude's Darwin Award.
Antonio was part of the SAG, so he got early release.
To
spin this one back around, on the theme of body shaming, we reviewed In Bruges.
What? Yes. Did we talk about In Bruges, the movie that came out in 2008?
Correct.
Yes.
And that's what this podcast is about?
It's about In Bruges.
Well, hopefully this episode strikes a balance between culture and fun.
Mm-hmm.
It is. I think... it is, like, to use the word you just used, oddly prescient in terms of cultural, like, a humor that would yet to really fully bloom. Yeah. Until about 2016, 2017.
So, Danny, why did you choose In Bruges for us? What was your experience with this film?
Well, I chose In Bruges because when I first saw it, I remember seeing it. I was in Washington, actually, visiting my parents, and I was with my best friend, Carrie, who's still my best friend today. And we saw, like, a preview for it or something like that on TV or whatever. And we're like, oh, cool, a comedy. Like, this goofy European comedy. And we saw it. And, you know, we were both, you know, just sort of, like, less experienced 20-year-olds who hadn't fully realized the horrors of modern reality. And when we saw it, we were like, that was not a comedy. That was very sad and very dark, because I guess we just wanted something else. And
so there was a bait and switch from the trailer to the actual film.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. And like, I don't know if I directly expressed it at that time, but I had a feeling. I didn't say like, this is a bad movie. I was sort of like, that was different, you know? And I would say, as I think I've watched it that first time, once probably in like in between now and then last week when I revisited it. And I have to say, I love it now. It's great. I don't know what comedy's done to my brain, but I got so much more out of it and loved it again, you know?
Yeah.
I'm on board. I love that movie. I think it was great.
Yeah, so I mean, it gets three thumbs up from us over here at the Eat, Pray, Judge podcast, but this was the first time that I saw it. So it slipped underneath my pop culture radar. And how about you, Sammy?
I mean, I'd heard of it, but I'd never, I'd obviously never seen it until recently. I think it slipped under a lot of people's radar. It had like a budget of $15 million.
Jeez,
first
Louise.
Weekend, made $457,000.
Yeah, it did not.
No.
It was not profitable.
Wow, that is like Hindenburg level disasters for a movie.
It kind of reminds me of a much better version of Boondock Saints.
That's what I was going to say, is like, this is a movie that is sort of the smart man's Boondock Saints, but because it is a little bit hard to grasp the first time or just sort of like understand some of the jokes, a lot of the dumb guy stuff that goes along with Boondock Saints is sort of, you know, doesn't translate.
I mean, it definitely appeals more to the viewer with a drier sense of humor and the ability to wrap their head around, British or Irish comedy stylings.
So for anybody that hasn't seen it, the plot is very simple. We have two hitmen. One is an older, experienced one. The other one is a young hitman. And they had a job go wrong in England. And now they have to take a train to Bruges and lie low there until their boss, Harry, tells them what their next orders are going to be.
Yeah.
The actors are Colin Farrell, who's the young hitman. I cannot remember the older guy.
Brendan Gleeson.
Brendan Gleeson, who is the older hitman or the more experienced one. And then Ralph Fiennes.
Yep. That's correct.
Ralph Fiennes, who is the boss, essentially.
Harry Waters.
Excellently creepy. Yeah. As he always is.
Ralph Fiennes isn't even present in the first half of the movie.
Just he's a voice on the phone, yeah.
But he's great. He's great.
He's very, very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so like you said, the first half of the movie, I thought, oh, this is like a Pulp Fiction knockoff. That's what I thought initially, because one thing the movie has is like a lot of witty dialogue and a lot of gangsters mm-hmm. or criminals mm-hmm. doing normal mundane things.
Right.
So it's like, oh, it felt like Jules and Vincent from Pulp Fiction.
Right.
Driving like around at the beginning of their, you know, in the car listening to Jungle Boogie.
Yeah, like a less cinematic version of Snatch.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Or like a Sopranos bottle episode, you know, like Chrissy and Polly hanging out in the Pine Barrens.
I have never watched The Sopranos. I'm sorry to everyone. I am not against watching it. It just evaded me, you know.
It did feel I get the Snatch reference. I felt like I wrote down. I felt like a Guy Ritchie Monty Python collaboration.
Yeah, very much movie. So.
But then it gets it moves from that. You know, at first I thought that this is trite. This is cliche. This is just gonna feel like, you know, witty gangsters doing normal things. And then, like, it goes deep, man. This movie goes real deep.
A lot of shifts.
It's funny because it is deep, but it's also dumb. But it's also it's very hard to describe. It's like they're doing a dumb man's thing in a smart way, sort of.
They're like a hitman Laurel and Hardy, basically, with Ken Gleason's character being sort of the more cerebral hitman to.
Yeah,
the almost slapstickish,
little
people hating stylings of Colin Farrell's Raymond.
I think if you were raised in a Catholic, like having gone to Catholic schools or any sort of mm-hmm. Theological training, this movie has a richer layers because it's a morality tale.
Really is.
Yeah, know? I mean all of the like homages and just sort of. Like metaphor are like extremely blatant, but not like terrible. Like Bruges, basically, which is in Belgium, is just like this, like set point that's basically almost like explicitly told to the viewer, like this is purgatory. It is neither a good place nor a bad place, right. and it's purgatory for these two people. And they say it to the point where they're like. Ken Gleason's character is like, I want to do sightseeing and I want to go see all the old buildings. And they go to a church and they start describing like purgatory. And like they go and they see that one painting where it's a triad painting where on one end it's heaven, the middle is purgatory, and then the right hand panel is hell. I can't remember what that painting
is. It's a Hieronymus Bosch painting.
Yeah, the Hieronymus Bosch painting. Who and is? They're just, and like they very explicitly say it where like Colin Farrell, who's hating everything. While they're doing this, it's like I like this painting, you know, like and just like he's like I like it. It's cool.
I love Hieronymus Bosch's work. The Garden of Eden, I think, was one of his paintings that I saw when I was in Spain. It's incredible. So he was a monk who kind of lost his mind on somewhat hallucinogenic yeast.
Yeah,
and kind of went into the hills and just started making basically religious culture art.
Well, they had that. That would happen all the time. The ergot fungus would interact with rye bread, and people didn't know that their bread was infected with this fungus, and it just created LSD type hallucinations, and entire towns would all get their bread from the same bakers and just wig out. Like simultaneously.
Yeah.
So no one knew that they were tripping. They had just all thought that they were in the middle of a rapture.
Yeah. They're all just like, oh, God is actually real. No.
It's kind of true. Like all of his paintings were basically morality based. So this one was called The Last Judgment. And it was basically The Last Judgment. Like a morality clause.
Right. And there are two other paintings that they look at in the museum right beforehand. And one of them is a judgment painting as well of a judge who is being flayed alive for having taken bribes. Mm-hmm. So basically, like, you know, being greedy, taking like doing bad things for money, which mm-hmm. is what hitmen do. They kill for money.
Right.
And then the other painting is it is the miser being visited by death. And it's a two panels, and one is a fat man who's the miser, and then death is like the little skinny ghoul mm-hmm. that's coming for him. So like you can't really you can't compromise. It doesn't matter how rich you are or how much you've saved up. Yo, death comes for all of us.
Yeah, like all the themes in it, like I said, are very, very on the bit. Like yeah, they hit you over the head with them. But it because it's incredibly European and like not and like everybody talks really fast in it, and you almost miss a lot of the lines.
I actually put subtitles on about 15, 20 minutes in just yeah. to be on the safe side.
Yeah. Right.
English is my first language, and you're going to have trouble.
But like Colin Farrell's character, quickly. Ray, we're still not that good at it.
Nope. Yeah, which is great. There's a lot of shade thrown in this film. Little people, Belgians, fat American tourists, Canadians. Pretentious anti-smoking Canadians.
Yeah, there's it's weird.
It's not a safe haven for those folk.
No, it's like I was telling Gabe earlier. There's a lot of interesting, like, to call this movie problematic is not correct. I think it's some weird adjacent thing from that, because they make a point of being like in the movie, like a lot of the gags in it are just like. Like uncouth profanity, where they're just sort of like, "I have one beer for me and one gay beer for my friend here." Yeah. Like, you know.
So there's tons of edgelord comedy in this that yes. predates edgelordness.
Yeah,
you know, and that's why like it. Some of it feels a little cringy. However, the moral underpinnings of the movie and the conversations that are being had kind of like. Make it tolerable to me. Like,
yeah,
agreed.
And it's kind of like it's. I think it's a palatable thing. Like, you know, can we have like? How do we have like a movie that's really that tries to touch on these profound moral questions, and then also sprinkle in enough stuff to get dummies.
Yeah.
To like laugh along with it.
Yeah, like I mean, I'm just straight up going to in order to illustrate. Just some of the lines in this. I will be saying some uncouth words.
Oh, sure.
Like, but one of the most blatant ones is like, okay, so as Gabe mentioned, a big thing throughout this movie is little people. Mm.
No pun intended.
They are. Yeah. Yes.
Do we call in the conversation like, is it a midget? And it's like, they prefer to be called dwarves.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the nomenclature is always changing. Is it little people? Is it dwarves? Is it midgets? Like, and which is like, I don't know, accurate to classify. They're all, I don't know.
I think yeah. dwarf is technically the correct, because little people seems condescending.
I think dwarf is correct now, but there's at one point where they've talked about it's like dwarves or whatever, and then they talk. I believe it's a scene where they're where Brendan Gleeson is like, "Oh, I want to go to the top of this tower." It's like, "Would that be fun for you, Ray? Would that be fun for you?" And then he's like, "No, I don't think it would be fun. I think if I were to weigh it up against." Fun, I would. It would be like being on one end of a teeter totter with a big fat black retarded girl on the other, and you're like, the what?
Yeah, and you're like, whoa, like
so, shots.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so yeah, and Ray specifically is Colin Farrell playing this character. You're like, he does so many hateful things.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is. He is a hateful human. He is a hitman who murders for money, mm-hmm. who accidentally kills a child while he's killing a priest.
Who, yes. Mance Rayder, by the way.
Yeah. Wait, is he Mance Rayder? Oh, right. The priest. The priest
was the guy that played Mance Rayder in Game of Thrones.
And he was also Caesar in the show Rome on HBO.
He is Mance. I'm recognizing his face, yeah.
And Colin Farrell's Ray is also, like, you know, glibly throws out these racist jokes. Homophobic jokes, mm-hmm. always, ordering a beer for himself and a gay beer for my friend.
Yeah, yeah.
And just hammers home how, like, the othering the dwarf mm-hmm. at every chance he can.
Yeah,
just,
it is very – honestly, I'm quite surprised no transgender jokes were made. Like, it seems,
I don't even think that was on the radar back
yeah,
then.
Yeah, I mean, like, if it was, they would have been like, blah, 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 blah.
Dude, you know? If it was made today, there would just be, like, trans, like, bathroom jokes left and right.
Yeah,
this.
Yeah, or some, I mean.
Which bathroom are you going to?
Yeah. Yeah. What are you choosing to be today?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I mean.
Are you sitting up or are you sitting down or standing up when you pee?
Yeah, but it's weird, though, because it's like, yes, all these things are, like, uncouth, and if you want to really push it, just like hateful, like they are, like mean. Yeah. They're very mean, but because it's so European and because it's before everything, it's just one of those things where it's like the thing that I like to say to people is like everybody was problematic before 2014. You know,
I mean that's what makes the script and the writer such to me it's such a great job. I mean, you're rooting for a guy that kills a kid. He's sort of the
like on paper
de facto
he
hero.
Yeah, on paper he deserves the judgment.
Absolutely,
he deserves
he
the judgment.
Knows he does.
And he yes, and it's a testament to Colin Farrell's acting and also the writing that they create this he also juxtaposed with this is like boyish and vulnerable and seems like able to and remorseful and able to change.
Right. I mean, also when I mean his comments his you know derogatory comments across the board, he does it but he's still so likable.
Right
enough, and it's. I mean, it is, and that's what it is. He has like a childlike innocence. This was his first hit. So what happens is he goes to murder a priest, accidentally kills a child in the church where he murders the priest.
Yeah.
So that's it's a botched hit, his first one, and him and Ken have to flee to Bruges.
Yeah.
Which is a town in Belgium.
The oldest well-preserved medieval town in all of Belgium.
Right.
Mm-hmm. From the 12th century.
Which is great because there's other Catholic undertones there, or religious.
Yeah.
So they have to hide out at bed and breakfast while their boss, Harry, tries to figure out what to do. Harry, played by Ralph Fiennes. So the little bit of a plot twist happens, and Ken is now awarded the task of killing Colin because you can't get away with murdering a child. So in their world of loose morals, there's certain codes that they have to live by.
Yeah, rigid morals. Now, Here's the thing about being a hitman is that I think you have a very short lifespan because in every movie, the hitman that kills an important person is then immediately murdered.
He's the target.
To
How
get
do you not
rid
understand?
Of the wit, you know, the chain of command.
I literally wrote down, "Murder is a slippery slope."
You
it
know?
Gets easier, then you're the next head on the wall.
Like whoever killed JFK was immediately killed and thrown into a cauldron of acid.
Now Frank Sinatra lived a long time.
Yeah, so he's
stand me up for dinner.
He's ordered to kill. He's ordered to kill Ray, and it should also be noted that this entire time. That Ray is basically suicidal. He basically says it is just sort of and Ken is like struggling with the prospect of having to kill him, even though he's probably killed like lots of people.
Right.
I would also mention, just from a movie perspective, this is a very weird Colin Farrell role, because I looked up Colin Farrell's like IMDb, and it sounds like he's sort of been like loosely acting since like the late 90s. Thereabouts, and everything before this was I can't be certain, but like one of the movies he was in before In Bruges was SWAT. So like just sort of a generic like 2003 dumb action movie.
And Phone Booth, I think, was another one. And that's the classic like new Hollywood talented good looking actor who does one for the studio, one for himself, one for, you know.
Yeah, so it kind of seemed like with this movie, it was definitely him just being like, maybe even so far as to say like taking a turn in his acting and being like, I want to do something interesting. And the funny part is like he does a good job acting, but in the beginning especially, it almost seems just like a little hammy. Like he's like, like almost sounds kind of like a like high royalty when he's talking, you know. But he eases into it as the movie goes on.
I mean, he did win a Golden Globe, and I think that was part of his childlike innocence, was to play that sort of over the top hamminess.
Yeah, it's not bad, and it's not oppressive. You notice it initially, and then you're just sort of like, well, I'm used to it now.
Yeah.
You know,
this is my favorite role that I've ever seen him in.
I like him better as less as a lead man and more as a quirky character actor.
Yeah.
You know, he's got comedic chops and he's got range. And I don't ever see him as a hero, you know? And I also liked him. We've talked about this before, but I loved him in True Detective Season 2.
Well,
did not see True Detective Season 2, but it apparently is terrible.
Well, you know, you're talking to the one guy over
here.
There's
one man on Earth that loves it.
I'm totally open to liking it. I mean, look, I don't know how much of you have watched Game of Thrones, but I thought the only problem with season 8 is that it was a little short. So come at me, fam. Yeah, I'll defend it. I don't care. It's, yeah, shut up. So I'm open to liking season 2 of True Detective.
Yeah. No. We'll sit down and have a watch party. You and I. And some Adderall.
Yeah.
All right. So
Adderall's the guest of honor.
Yeah. I you know what? I love how Christian this movie is.
It's so Christian.
It's incredibly. It's just religious. It's
right.
Incredibly religious.
And it's steeped in. It is religious, and it's steeped in these ideas that when I say Christian, I mean steeped in these like philosophical debates that were going on throughout Christianity, through Catholicism into Protestantism. And you can look at this as these are the two thieves that were on the sides of Jesus at Golgotha.
Yeah.
You know? And they're the other two dudes that were crucified because, you know, the writing's on the wall as hitmen who botched this job. They're both going to die by the end of this, regardless of who it is that's going to kill them. You know, it's a dark comedy and it's going to end poorly for them. And so as dead men walking, that's the same thing with these two thieves. That were hammered to the crosses next to Jesus.
Yes.
But one, you know, chooses to, and it's this dialogue between them where one is like believes in something higher, and the other one has no faith.
Mm-hmm. That's a good take on this one. I didn't even think about that. That makes Ralph Fiennes Lucifer, and then the B&B keeper. It was Mary Magdalene.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Well, it's happening during Christmas,
right?
And during Christmas time, and Christmas hasn't arrived yet, and she is she's like a pregnant innkeeper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of things I can't tell if they tried to do this on purpose, but a lot of things do come back in it. So one thing that happened, I'm gonna jump around a little bit here, but
yeah,
like,
and that's what we do.
At the beginning of the movie, he's like trying to get to the top of this tower to just look over onto the town of
the
Bruges.
The belfry of Bruges.
Yeah, the belfry. And the guy, there's this Belgian guy whose basic, his job is to be an asshole or just to be very indifferent to everybody. So when Brendan Gleeson is trying to pay to go up there, he's got what appears to be close to €5, but he only has like €4.90, and it's all in change. He's like, that's good enough, right? And then he's like, €5, and he keeps tapping, and the guy keeps tapping the thing, like pointing at it. But something that happens later on in the movie is when he has to get to the top of that tower and signify that he's going to jump off of it. He has a bunch of change that he can like sprinkle onto the ground below.
And he wouldn't have had that change
yeah.
if he'd been able to slide in earlier.
Yeah, yeah. Also, I think it's incredibly – this is at this point in the movie, Ralph Fiennes' character is with him. And it's incredibly funny when Ralph Fiennes just slaps the shit out of this Belgian guy.
That was the same guy. He started poking his head.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't go up there.
Yeah, the tower is closed, yeah. Englishman. And then Gleason just like walks away, just knowing that he's basically going to pistol whip him.
other brilliant callbacks that happen at this belfry are, you know, Colin Farrell's character, Ray, he's seated outside, and these large Americans ask him about if he'd gone up to the belfry. And he discourages them from going up because they're so big.
Call them elephants.
That he's it's almost like concern trolling, where he's like, "Yo, you really shouldn't go up there. Like you're too fat. You're too fat. Why would you want to go up there?"
Yeah, yeah.
And but we find out that the belfry was closed later because a fat American had a heart attack.
Yeah.
Trying to get to the top of the belfry. So even though he was offensive and wrong in how he was
to save a life.
He almost saved a life.
Yeah. It's very fun.
That is a good callback.
To jump around again, like there's this one point where Ray's just hanging out. And again, he sees this dwarf who is a prominent character in the movie.
Right, the American dwarf.
The American dwarf who is also acting in a sort of like weird dream sequence movie or whatever. This sort of like weird, just this goofy film. And he hates it. And his whole job is to be dressed up like a child almost.
Yeah.
And he sees him with as he refers to it, a whore in a bar.
And yeah, from Amsterdam.
A very pretty prostitute.
A very pretty prostitute. And they talk about how earlier in the day, when Colin Farrell saw the dwarf, he was just, he waved at him, and the dwarf was just walks, didn't wave back. And so he got, and like, this is Colin Farrell's character just being goofy, and he walks up to him while he's, the dwarf is making out with this prostitute and sex worker, if you would. And she, and he's just like, he's like, why didn't you wave at me earlier? And he's like, look, I was on horse tranquilizers. I wasn't waving at anything. Except maybe a horse. And
maybe a horse, right?
Yeah, and there's lots of great quippy lines in it where the sex worker is just sort of like, I came down to Bruges from Amsterdam because I could get a better price for my pussy out here. Like it's a lot of quick little things. Which again make it's very much like the smart man's Boondock. Yeah. And barely. Like it just like it really toes the line on it.
Yeah. Man, I loved Ray's sort of, so you know, they're killing time, waiting to get killed or kill. And one guy, Brendan Gleeson's character, Ken, is trying to just absorb all the culture and the art and the history.
Mm-hmm.
And Ray is out here indulging in all of the sensual desires of the world to escape his mind.
Yes.
And escape the torment of the sins that he has committed. And he has the most hilarious dates.
Oh, yeah. Best first date I've ever seen.
Yeah, greatest first date.
Yeah, he goes on a date with a French woman and
Chloe.
Chloe, yeah. And like they're in a smoking restaurant and he ends up beating up a Canadian.
Because he thinks the Canadian is American.
Because the Canadian, yeah.
Who he subsequently blames for John Lennon's murder and Vietnam.
Yeah. And they end up after that scene going back to her place and making out, and he gets a bunch of drugs. The scene that I just described where he's talking to the dwarf happens, and at the end of that he goes, do you want to do some drugs with me? Or do you want to do some cocaine? So after he's like insulted this dwarf and everything, they're just sort of like, oh, cocaine's on the table. And then they go back, and that goes to what is possibly the best scene in the entire movie, where the dwarf is just yacked out of his mind and talking about the race war, which is very fun.
And I'm watching that scene and I'm getting physically ill from like just watching people do cocaine on screen. I can't watch it anymore.
I get paranoid contact highs when I see people doing cocaine or smoking weed on film. I wrote that down. I become nervous.
I get jittery and nauseous.
Yeah.
They really hammer into the dwarf thing because the dwarf is talking about the race war and how what's going on with the race war. And Colin Farrell is like, well, the black dwarfs, we would be with the black people and the white dwarfs would be with the white people. And the dwarf is just like, yes, of course. And
I think they're trying to do, this is a comment on the idea of punching down.
Yeah.
You know, because they're all in this room doing coke and they're all like equals in that. And the dwarf who you know should feel offended for,
mm-hmm.
because he's being talked down to by Colin Farrell, is a rabid racist.
He's weird, and Colin Farrell's just sort of like, well,
Pakistanis,
are the Vietnamese going to be with the blacks? And it's like, and the dwarf's like, yes. What about the Pakistanis? Yes. It's like, oh, well, I'm going with the blacks then. It's like, you can't choose your side.
And we find out here that Ken, we get some history on the old wise hitman, that he had a African-American wife who was murdered, and that Harry avenged him. So the boss killed the killer of Ken's wife.
Mm-hmm.
So Ken is beholden to Harry and has loyalty and love for his employer.
Oh, I didn't realize she was American.
I don't know what she was.
I think she just said black.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was his whole take on it. I think that was taking a shot at inherent American racism, by the way. Because it's ingrained.
Yeah. And it's, the dwarf is like, just like, he's like, so where am I supposed to be on your fucking race war? And he's like, look, you gotta go with your conscience. Like he Ray's talking all about how he wants to be with the blacks because they have the Vietnamese, but because Brendan Gleeson's character's wife was black and got killed, he gets a pass.
And I think this is all a comment on black and white morality.
Yeah.
You know, as much as it is about red, like, so it's operating on two levels. One level is this like offensive, edgelord humorous race war level, but also, you know, this whole film is about, do you have black and white morality, like Harry,
mm-hmm.
who's like, if you kill a kid, you have to be murdered.
Yeah.
Or, do you have to, you know, act on your conscience?
Yeah. There's another little scene where like he gets the gun to kill Ray.
Ken gets the gun from Yuri.
Mm-hmm. Yuri, who's the just
yoga practicing, alcove loving Russian.
yeah, who's just like, if you wanted to kill a man, I would recommend doing it in the alcove.
Yeah.
Is that the right word? Alcove.
In Koenig Park, you go the alcove, just so peaceful.
Yeah, quiet. Yeah. Yeah, there's lots of weird little scenes like that. And that it's at that point when he's trying to kill him, or he's attempting to kill him, that Ray has his own gun that he's gotten, and he almost kills himself. And then that kind of takes the movie to this other turn where Brendan Gleeson has decided he's not going to kill Ray, and he wants him to just get out of town and start over, you know.
Well, suicide versus murder.
Yeah.
You know, and this to
which
me
are
goes
both
to
capital sins, right?
Yeah, but I think about suicide's even worse, right? In my estimation, according to this film, and it makes me think about, like, this movie makes me think a lot about predestination versus choice.
Right.
And predestination, everything is in God's hands.
Mm.
You know, it's a mechanical world. God's already wound up all the pieces. And that's why, you know, you're like almost not even responsible. You're held responsible for the sins you commit, but the sins you commit are almost random. Like Ray kills that priest and accidentally kills the kid.
Yeah.
And now he has to live with that accident.
Well, yeah. Also, through the guise of Catholicism, I mean, I would say that it definitely weighs heavily on suicide being a greater sin than almost anything.
And it's because you're taking the power into your own hands.
Exactly.
As opposed to letting it be in God's hands.
And also, I mean, there's no room for coming back. There's no absolvement left once you kill yourself. You're taken off the table. So if you're a murderer, you can go to confession and have your sins absolved. Anything's forgivable, according to the Bible.
Yeah. Well, not in terms of this Old Testament Harry
right.
religion, which is very black and white. Like, you do this thing, you're going to die. Harry, the most clemency or mercy that Harry gives is, well, you'll get to see Bruges first.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's like during a phone call that he's having with Brendan Gleeson's character, where he's just like, did he like everything? And Brendan Gleeson is just lying, being like, yeah, he loved it, even though he didn't. He's like, good, I sent him there with you so he could enjoy stuff before he dies by your hand. Yeah, so at that, you know, Harry comes to Bruges because Brendan Gleeson basically told him to fuck off over the phone.
Can we say that phone scene is probably my favorite scene in the movie?
Wait, which one?
When Ken calls Harry to tell him that he put Ray on a train, he's not going to kill him, and now it's up to Harry to just show up and do what he needs to do.
Yeah.
So Ken is basically saying that he'll take the bullet. He'll sacrifice himself. He's taking a moral stand.
Yeah, and it cuts over to Ray, who's somewhere in England, and he's so like blown away, he basically destroys his phone, his office phone, and
Harry's in England.
Harry's in England. He destroys his office phone, and his wife is just sort of like, what are you doing? And he's like. And she's like, it's an inanimate object. And then he comes back at her, you're an inanimate fucking object. And there's lots of great little lines like that.
You know, as much as that's a throwaway line, it is also the way that Harry views the world.
Yeah.
Like every person is a
disposable.
Is a moving mechanistic piece. Mm-hmm. And our feelings and emotions for each other don't matter. It's just the thing that we do. And making sure that you are following the rules.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's, and then later on, when he's apologizing to his wife, he's like, sorry for calling you an inanimate fucking object. So he had, like, you're right, he has this morality where he's just sort of like, I said that, but I'm sorry.
He is also, Harry is a sympathetic human being.
Yes.
He's an asshole, but he loves his family. Hey, he's a gangster with a heart of gold.
I mean, he's doing this to write the death of an innocent child.
Yeah. Like,
that's why he has to kill Ray.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, what leads to my favorite scene in the movie is, I mean, spoilers or whatever, but the final scene where he's shooting, when he shoots Raymond in the street, in the square, he accidentally hits the little person. And he thinks he's killed a child because he doesn't know the dwarf is dressed up as a child.
Yeah.
So immediately seeing that, he sticks a gun in his mouth and he goes, honor.
Right.
Yeah.
And then blows his head off.
And Ray has some goodness to him because Ray tries to stop him.
Yeah.
He tries to stop his own murderer from committing suicide.
Right. That happened twice in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other funny scene is right before Harry and Brendan Gleeson are about to, like, go up to the top of the tower again and duke it out. And he's just sort of telling Harry how he's an asshole. And he's like, look, Harry, I love you, but you're a cunt. You've always been a cunt, and you're going to die a cunt, and you're going to live on your cunt kids. And he's like, don't call my kids a fucking cunt. And he's like, all right, I retract that bit. The comedy is extremely English.
And these, like, hard-ass gangster types, you know, Harry's, Ralph Fiennes' Harry reminds me a lot of Sexy Beast. Of the, I don't know if you've seen that one, but Ben Kingsley
has
also played a hard-ass gangster of the same cut from the same cloth.
I don't know that one.
So Sexy Beast is another one to watch. If you like this type of like hard-boiled gangster dialogue between British men, Sexy Beast.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I think The Long Good Friday, that's another one.
That sounds very familiar.
Yeah, but now this movie made me want to go back and watch like old British gangster films.
Yeah, it harkens to a specific type of genre that is, like I said earlier, kind of similar to Snatch, Guy Ritchie films like Snatch and Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels. It has like a certain they have a certain pacing to them that makes them uniquely European. And like, you know, we've kind of been mentioning the entire time, everything, I've said a lot of offensive things, you know, in theory, so far, but it just feels different when you look at them through this, like, 2008 context, and perhaps that's my own sort of ignorance to just being like, anything said before this time was offensive or whatever, in such a way, but you definitely don't see any malice. It doesn't feel as malicious.
I mean, this feels like a morality tale in the same way that Seven is a morality tale.
Sure.
And it's a movie that I think you could watch and talk about in a theology class or an ethics class.
Absolutely.
So it's a cool rumination on morality and mortality and redemption.
Yeah, and honestly, it's truly surprising to me that the movie itself hasn't been co-opted by dumb guys. Like, the fact that we're able to talk about it is in itself quite surprising. Because, like, as it's been referred to many times, this movie truly, truly walks the line of, like, dumb guy culture. And I think if you looked carefully, you would find several, state colleges throughout the early 2010s, where you did see an In Bruges poster on the wall, but it wouldn't be everyone, and it's not going to have nearly the proliferation of, say, a Bob Marley poster or a Scarface poster.
Right.
It's like you're only going to see an In Bruges poster one every 20, maybe 30 places.
This movie came out in a time when going to Bruges was where real people lived in Bruges. I'm sure that no one lives in Bruges anymore because the whole place has been turned into an Airbnb theme park.
It's the head of NATO. It's where NATO's headquartered.
In Bruges?
Yep. Also the head of the EU.
No fucking way. Really?
I believe so.
Damn. That's the other funny thing from a sheer pragmatic level is you have to wonder, it's just like, what happened to it? It's like, was there a noticeable uptick in tourism or decrease in tourism after this movie came out? Because the whole movie, the damn name is in the title.
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder. I always thought that was like Brussels, but I guess Bruges, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, Belgium is a very, I mean, this is, I think it's sort of lost on us Americans, but Belgium is a very goofy place as well, and they touch on it in the movie, and it's funny because, like, when we think about, like, Europe, we just think of a big chunk, and, like, we know what Belgium is, we maybe know what Luxembourg is, but the vast majority of Americans don't, and, like, yeah, Belgium's... Yeah. Goofy as shit.
What I know about Belgium is that the best twin action film, Double Impact, stars Jean-Claude Van Damme from Belgium.
Yes.
And they also, their military, that recently they realized that all of their men who were in the military were getting really sad and homesick. So they, their moms in Belgium petitioned to have more leave for the soldiers to come back home to hang out with their moms. So
yeah.
The Belgium... military, they're all mama's boys.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a weird nation state that is like one of those places that in like say World War I, for example,
buckled immediately.
Not only buckled immediately but also had like the full potential to have just straight up been like a weird other thing, in the same way that there was the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Uh-huh. A little bit east of that, Belgium is basically just like a weird annexation of France in a strange way.
Yeah, I can't wait to go visit.
Yeah, I'm sure it's great. Also, they speak French and Flemish there, you know.
I wanted to correct myself. Please. Belgium is the headquarters. I'm sure it's probably Brussels, not Bruges.
Yeah.
For NATO and the European Union.
I was just thinking that Bruges seems like it's such a preserved medieval city that they wouldn't want to add too many flourishes of modernity.
Mm-hmm. And I'm
like,
sure.
So unlike DC.
Right. There's no like brutalist architecture in the center of Bruges. Right.
I'm sure, honestly, their bathrooms are probably very weird. Like, if it really is that old, then, like, they didn't have fucking bathrooms in, like, 1200, yeah. In the 12th century. It was just, like, there was probably a room with a pot in it, but yeah. I'm sure the plumbing there is weird.
That's a shitbox. Another one of these films that I'd recommend strongly, especially in this era of film, Michael Caine had a movie called Harry Brown, which is a morality tale about a British gangster, which is very well worth watching. I think it came out in 2009. But if you like this sort of style,
I remember that's when a good one. That came out, and it was another one of those movies that I'm sure was probably pretty good, but yeah. Just like was mostly unreceived.
Right.
Like I want to say it was even later than that. I think it came out in like 2014 or 15, maybe.
The Harry Brown one was 2009.
Was it?
It was.
Wow, that was a long time ago.
I think after Dark Knight, I don't know if Michael Caine's been working.
I just remember
he could have retired after Jaws.
It's just like one of those movies that gets totally not ground up, but just lost
right.
In the production machine of Hollywood. You're just sort of like, yeah, we can make a lot of movies.
It's definitely a good watch, and it's very British, but it's also it's different. I don't think it's as religiously based.
It's in the notes, and you know what I got to say about this. That in Bruges fits into both praying and judging for
it does.
The podcast
this
title.
Might be our first pray.
Yeah. This is the most spiritual film mm-hmm. that
lot
we've encountered.
A lot of judgment. Yeah.
Yeah. More judgment than the film Judgment Night.
Little to no eating.
Do you rate the...
A lot of drinking.
A lot of drink. Do you rate the movie? Do you give it like 5 bags of popcorn or something like that? Or?
we make it up as we go.
Yeah.
I give this movie 10 gay beers.
Yeah.
I give it
10 straight beers.
I give it 11 rosaries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And 5 bags of popcorn as well.
Yeah, this movie's great if you like witty dialogue, transgressive humor, Colin Farrell, and some ruminations on ethics.
Absolutely.
Yeah, if you're a dumb guy who listens to Come Town, you probably might like this as well.
Controversial.
Yeah.
Ooh, well, I loved it, man. Danny, awesome. Thank you so much for picking this film.
It was a fun one, and I'm glad I got to rewatch it. And also, all of you could watch it because it just sort of chills in the download on Netflix.
Yep.
Totally it's watchable there.
Great film.
Yeah. Danny, where can we find you?
You can find me like across platform on most social media platforms at Danny Feltz. I would say if you truly want to engage with me as a human being and not don't send me a random Facebook friend request. It's ostracizing and dumb if I don't know you and you're not trying to also have a question about something. But feel free to follow me on Instagram or Twitter. You know, I would even say just mostly Instagram because that's where I'm much, much more present. You know, I don't find the need to tweet very often, but I do love taking pictures of the thing and putting a caption under it. So please. Also, you see my various wares that I sell there. I do a lot of other different things. So if I sell, if I'm selling a thing, it'll show up on Instagram.
Yo, my man's making buttons over here and pins.
I do. Yeah, you should commission me to make buttons for you for $30 for 100 buttons. The one that's the size of a quarter.
All right. So check out Danny Feltz doing all sorts of crafts on the IG.
Yeah.
And Sammy, anything going on?
Just working on this upcoming restaurant project, which I will talk more about as the time approaches.
Excellent. Okay, and you can find me at GabePacheco.com. And the most important thing to do for us here at Eat, Pray, Judge is to give us a 5-star review on iTunes and, you know, just leave a little review. Leave a little review. Tell your friends about it. All right, we love you. Thanks. Bye. I heard the Cali never rains in New York's wide awake. First, let's see the West End. I'll show you to my bedroom. I'm liking this American boy, American.